For 3.5 years, Jesus wandered through Israel with a purpose. With every sign he performed, with every word he proclaimed, he was pointing out to something greater. His miracles were more than mere performance. They were a display of power. His teachings were more than about being good. They were about knowing God. In every village and city he entered, Jesus' words and actions created a division among people. Some were afraid and were determined to destroy him. But others saw that Jesus was no ordinary man. And in the final days of Jesus' life, that belief is put to the ultimate test. The moment of truth has arrived. The hour has come. Is Jesus another man? Or is he God?
Hey, Traders Point, it is so good to be with you tonight. If you are new or just getting to know us, we are so glad that you joined us. Hey, if you have your Bible or a Bible app, I would love for you to join me in John chapter 13, all right? John chapter 13. Last week, we finished up John chapter 12, and so we're going to pivot into chapter 13 tonight. Last week, we saw as Jesus entered the city of Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, and the crowd on the streets were going crazy. They were waving palm branches. They were welcoming Jesus as the victorious king they thought he was going to be. And instead, Jesus rode on a donkey, and he said, "I'm not necessarily the king that you want, but I'm definitely the king that you need." You see, the crowd, they wanted Jesus to fix their immediate circumstance. They wanted Jesus to make life better right now. And Jesus came to give a different kind of life. It was the life that they need, eternal life. But it's not what they wanted. And so we watched as the crowd had to choose. Am I willing to accept Jesus for who he is, or am I going to reject him because he doesn't give me what I want? And that was John chapter 12. And John now pivots us from the public life of Jesus, the public ministry of Jesus, to a series of private conversations between Jesus and his disciples. And that's what we're going to see in chapter 13. If you do not have a Bible, we would love to give you one. You can take the one in the seat back in front of you, or you can stop by Connection Central on your way out. But you need to know that here we like to really break down books of the Bible and study them chapter by chapter, break them down to understand what they mean, and then ask the question, what does that mean for us? And so today in John 13, we're going to see Jesus do something kind of a little odd and a little peculiar, and then we're going to be left with the question, am I willing to follow Jesus' example, right? Am I willing to, I see what he does, am I willing to do that in my own life, right? So we're just going to dive right in, and we're going to break it down. We're going to spend some time understanding what it means and then ask a few questions of ourselves, all right? So John chapter 13, verses 1 through 4, if you'll join me, we'll get started. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. All right, let's pause right there, and I want to make a few observations, all right? First thing, a little bit on the lighter side. I think this once and for all decides what we should call the third meal of the day, okay? How many of you would call the third meal of the day dinner, right? Just raise your hand, like this is what you say, okay? How many of you would say supper, all right? Very good, okay. Now, I grew up about 4 hours south of here, and we said supper, and the Bible says supper, so we win, all right? We win on that one. It is forever known as supper, all right? So here's what's going on. Jesus and his friends, his disciples, are having a supper here in the waning hours of Jesus' life. And what these first four verses are setting the scene for what Jesus is about to do. But before we pass by it too fast, we need to make sure that we understand the full picture of what's happening. So it says here that Jesus' hour has come, all right? Jesus' hour has come. That means that God's plan for Jesus, that the reason that he showed up, this entire mission that Jesus was on, This was the moment that was to come to fulfillment. Right? This the hour had come. God's plan was ready to be finished. It was right on the doorstep. His hour had come. Now, if you'll remember back in John chapter 2, Jesus was at a wedding reception, and he was there with his disciples, and his mom was there. And the host had run out of wine, which was a big party foul. And the mom and Jesus' mom comes and says, "Hey, can you fix this? I know you do things. And so can you fix this? Can you make some more wine?" And Jesus says, "Mom, you're embarrassing me in front of my friends." He doesn't say that. He says, "Hey, mom, my hour has not yet come. It is not ready. I'm not ready to be fully fulfilled. I'm not ready to be fully glorified in front of all these people." But here in John 13, we see that the hour has come. And I love this picture because it shows that Jesus, if you follow his life throughout the Gospels, he was never in a hurry. Do you notice that? It was like, never. Hey, Jesus like missed his appointment. Or Jesus hit the snooze button a couple of times too late and he missed the thing that he was supposed to be at. As you watch Jesus live out his life, he was always perfectly in control. He was where he was supposed to be when he was supposed to be there. You see, God's plan is not to be rushed. And I am a rusher, all right? I admit that, I proclaim that I am one that is impatient, I am anxious, and I want to take control. And Jesus, throughout his entire life, he's walking through his world, he's encountering different people, and now the hour has come. You can kind of feel the weight that is coming down on the narrative here. And then it says that Jesus, he loved his own until the end. It really perfectly describes the way Jesus loved those with whom he spent his life. See, Jesus, he loved this group of disciples patiently when they completely missed the point over and over and over again. And he was gracious with them when he was calling out their sin. And he was generous with them, giving them love that they had not earned. And his love was steadfast, that it did not bail, it did not fail. He saw it to the end, even to the cross. And I love that Jesus' love there for his disciples very much describes his love for you and me. That he is patient with us, and he is gracious with us, and he is generous with us, and he does not quit. He loves us to the end, he even loves us to the cross. And so John is painting this picture, and he says it would be incomplete if you didn't know that there was a betrayer at the table. He says Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, he is there at the dinner. Now, if maybe you don't know much about the Bible, but there's a really good chance that you've heard of Judas before, okay? Judas was the most famous turncoat in the history of the world. He followed Jesus. He saw Jesus perform miracles. He heard Jesus preach. He spent days upon months upon multiple years with Jesus. Yet his heart was never transformed, and within hours, he was going to stab Jesus in the back. Now, the relationship between Jesus and Judas is one I think we need to pay extra attention to in chapter 13. As I was reading and studying it, that relationship between those two men completely blew me away, and we're going to watch to see what that full impact, those implications are. So watch as Jesus and Judas interact. Let's keep going in John 13. John says that the dinner is set. They have all gathered together. The hour has come. Judas is about to betray Jesus. And then Jesus, again, he just has this habit of doing the oddest thing, all right? Look at verse 4. He, Jesus, laid aside his garments and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that was wrapped around him. So what's up with the feet, right? Let's talk about the feet for a bit. How many of you would just say, like we all know, feet are gross, right? We can all admit that. It is fact, okay? Feet are gross. Now imagine feet 2,000 years ago, right? These feet would have seen a lot of wear and tear. During this time, there was very primal modes of transportation, so the majority of people were walking where they went. They were not walking on pavement. They were walking on dirt roads. And this was a time before sophisticated sewage solutions existed. So you can imagine what they stepped in. So these feet, they were dried and they were cracked and they were bruised. Okay. In 2010, I went on a short-term mission trip to Nairobi, Kenya with a team from Traders Point. And one day, we ended up outside of the city at a school there. And once we had gotten to know the kids, they wanted to play a game of soccer with us, okay? So I looked around for a patch of green grass for which we were going to play soccer on, and I did not find one. I found a dirt patch with dirt and rocks and two soccer goals, okay? They rolled out the soccer ball, and I noticed that the kids seemed to be missing a key piece of equipment, okay? Shoes, all right? They were not wearing shoes. And so at one point in the game, I am a novice, in fact, an embarrassment at soccer, okay? So do not take this for much credit. But there was a moment where the ball was between me and one of the Kenyan kids on the other team, all right, right here, and we were both going to kick it. And the problem was, is that it was like right here-ish, okay? So right here is like the danger zone for my hamstrings, all right? Or my hopes and dreams, all right? Like right there, all of it's gonna fall apart. And so we both try to kick the ball in midair, and both of us miss, and we kick each other's foot, my shoe to his bare foot, right? Now, at that moment, I was pretty convinced that I had just broken my foot, all right? And I was going to go to a Kenyan emergency room, and they would just cut it off, right? Like, I just thought, this is probably what's about to happen. The kid turns around and just runs away, like nothing had ever happened. The grown man over here near tears, and the kid just runs away. See, after years of running and playing on dirt and rocks, his feet had become tough, almost numb. They were just calloused, which was a lot like the feet of the disciples in this moment. So imagine dried, cracked feet full of who knows what, and then they all get to dinner. Now, the job of washing the feet was actually the lowest thing that anyone could do, right? It was lower than even what servants would do. So if there was a Jewish family and they had a Jewish servant, they wouldn't even make him wash the feet. They would go find another servant that was a Gentile, one that was outside the faith, and they would bring him in to wash everyone's feet before they had dinner. So you can imagine the disciples gather around the table, and they're all kind of looking at each other, right? Like, all right, who's going to do the thing that no one wants to do, right? I'm a disciple of a rabbi. And I am one of the inner 12 of the Son of God. I mean, this is, if it's below the lowest of servants, it's definitely below me. And you can imagine their surprise and probably embarrassment as Jesus gets up and he ties on a towel and he starts washing their feet. John describes it and he says he took out his outer garment off and he was left with a towel on. And so not only was he going to do the job of a servant, but he even took on the appearance of a servant. One commentator wrote that Jesus did not lay down his deity in this moment, but he definitely surrendered his dignity. This was a humiliating act of service, and the Son of God was doing it. This is the same Son of God that was at the creation of the world. The same Son of God that carved out the Pacific Ocean and raised up the Himalayan mountains. I mean, that God is now on his knee, and he is washing the feet of the disciples. Just imagine this picture. And we're going to see in verse 6, as one of his disciples named Peter, he kind of speaks up, right? Now, before we judge Peter too harshly, we need to all embrace one thing. We are Peter, okay? We are Peter. I am, and you are, and we all are. If you're reading through the Gospels and you see Peter react to a situation, you can pretty much bet that's exactly the way you would have acted, okay? Peter was impetuous, and he was emotional, and he often spoke before he thought. And in verse 6, we're going to watch one of Peter's classic foot-in-mouth situations, and we're going to see how Jesus deals with it, all right? Join me, verse 6 of chapter 13. He, Jesus, came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" And Jesus answered him, "What I am doing, you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Well, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." And Jesus said to him, "The one who is bathed does not need to wash except his feet, but is completely clean. and you are clean, but not every one of you. For he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, not all of you are clean. All right, can we just all appreciate Peter here? All right, like Peter's my man. Peter's my dude because it's exactly the way I would have handled this exact situation. Let's like break down this dialogue between Peter and Jesus, okay? So Jesus is going around and he's washing the feet of the disciples. And I imagine it's one of those incredibly awkward, tense situations where everybody's thinking the same thing, but no one will say it. Right? You ever been in one of those? Like everybody's looking at each other and like, I know you're thinking what I'm thinking, but we're not going to say it because she'll get mad. You know, like that whole awkward tension. And I love Peter because he's willing to say the thing that no one else is willing to say. Jesus gets to Peter and Peter says, Jesus, what you doing? That seems super weird that you are our leader and you are washing our feet. Like, I do not understand why you would be doing this. And Jesus, in a very gracious and fatherly way, he says, Peter, I know you don't get it yet, but someday you will. Someday my entire life will actually make sense, where right now you're only getting snapshots. Last week we talked about that Jesus' life only makes sense in his victory over death. Once we fully understand who Jesus is, then we can piece together his entire life and the Gospels. And so Peter says, that is not good enough for me. Jesus, you will not wash my feet. Now look, I don't know everything, all right? In fact, I don't know most things. But one thing I feel confident in saying is telling Jesus what he is not allowed to do is a bad idea, all right? Just a bad idea. Aren't you glad you came to church for that insight, right? Telling Jesus what he is and is not allowed to do is something that I would highly discourage, all right? You're welcome, all right? So Peter says, hey, Jesus, you will not wash my feet. And while it's easy to chuckle at Peter's slip of the tongue here, I'm afraid in my life, it sounds awfully familiar. Maybe you have come to Jesus, and Jesus is your king, and he is your Lord, and you made that decision, and maybe you got baptized, and you wore this t-shirt that said, all in, and you were like, I am in with Jesus. And maybe you even sang a song, and it said, take my life, Lord, let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee, right? Like, you're saying, like, that is it. But if someone were to really investigate the agreement that you made, they would find some fine print at the bottom with an asterisk, right? They would say, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee, except for my bank account, right? Like at the very bottom. Hey, take my life and let it be except for my marriage. Or take my life and let it be except for my career. And we've embraced this fine print as if we can say, look, isn't 99.9% of my life good enough, Jesus, right? I mean, it's the vast majority of it. You own more of it than I do. Like, isn't that enough? And we sound a whole lot like Peter saying, Jesus, you're not going to wash my feet. See, many of us have invited Jesus into our home and told him to stay out of certain rooms, saying like, hey, you can even make up space in the living room. You can be in the basement. You can go to the kitchen, but you stay out of that room. That's mine. And I'm still going to own it. And that's exactly the attitude that Peter has here. He's saying, Jesus, you will not wash my feet. And in verse 8, Jesus kind of blows Peter back and he says, look, if you don't let me wash you, you are not with me. Right? Now, this gives me the impression that maybe Jesus is talking about a little bit more than just washing feet here in this moment. Right? I think he's teaching us something a little bit bigger. See, Jesus is saying, unless you let me serve and sacrifice for you, you don't have a part in me. See, there are a lot of us that if we were being super honest, we would have stood where Peter said, where Peter stood and said, Jesus, you're not washing my feet. I don't need it. Because I have my own washcloth and I have my own water and I have my own soap. And like, I'm really scrubbing them with good works. And I'm just going to do enough good to where I can finally earn your credit. Or I'm going to scrub my feet and I can do it on my own with church attendance. Or with just being a good person. And so, Jesus, I don't need you to wash my feet because I can wash them on my own. And Jesus is clearly saying here in verse 8, if you don't let me wash your feet, if you don't let me give you the grace that you need, you don't have a part with me. And again, I love Peter because Peter swings the pendulum. Did you see that? He goes, hey, first of all, like 1 second, he's saying, Jesus, you will not wash my feet. And then Jesus is saying, well, you can't be with me. He says, okay, well, then give me the whole shower, right? Like, Peter is the best. I love Peter. From one moment, he's saying, do not touch me, Jesus. This is weird. And then the next thing he says, well, just dump it on, Jesus. Let's go. Like, why just a little bit? And Jesus easily could have said, Peter, stop it. You're ruining the moment, all right? Just stop it. You're making it weird. But luckily, Jesus is far more patient than I am. And he graciously says, Peter, you're clean, but you still need me to wash your feet. Right? You're clean. Like, you're clean. Don't worry about it. You don't need to shower, but I still have to clean your feet. So what is Jesus talking about there? You see, Jesus is talking about our cleanliness in front of God. He's not just describing the state of their feet at this particular dinner, in this particular moment, in this particular room, for this particular meal. He's actually painting a much bigger picture. He's talking about our cleanliness in front of God. 1 John 1:8-9 say this. It says, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So here's what's happened, is that our sin has brought a mess upon us. Okay? And I think we know that. We may not say it a lot, but we certainly can feel it because it made our relationships messy. And sin has corrupted our passions and our desires and our ambitions. And most of all, sin has put a divide between us and God. It is a mess. And Jesus has clearly said, this is why I showed up. I showed up on a rescue mission to save you from sin, to save you from that mess. And the Bible is incredibly clear that Jesus' sacrifice for us on the cross was enough to cover it all. There was not a shortcoming of sacrifice from Jesus. He covered it all. In fact, Hebrews 10 says that Jesus once and for all wiped out sin. He once and for all defeated death. We are forgiven. We are clean. We are saved. All right, that is not in doubt. And so the stress of do I need to like reapply for salvation every time that I sin? Right, I know that I had that struggle growing up. That I had somehow come to the conclusion that if I wasn't careful, I would die before I had asked for forgiveness from sin, and then I would be held accountable to that because I hadn't asked for forgiveness frequently enough or as soon enough. And it really kind of owned me. Like, I felt a lot of guilt about that. And the Bible's saying, no, you're clean, like clean. But you still need to wash your feet. See, Jesus is saying that you are forgiven, but there is still a need for daily confession of sin. See, there is this rumor going around that when it comes to Christianity, when it comes to Jesus, there's kind of this one-time decision, right? You decide once, you get dunked, you get out, you get your card for heaven, and then it's over, right? Like, that's kind of the whole process. It's finished, and you can just ride out the rest of life and just do whatever you want. And Jesus is saying, no, this is more than a one-time decision. You are clean, saved, but there is still a need to wash your feet. There's still a need for daily confession for sin. And so in my life, I can have assurance and I can have comfort and I can have confidence that I am saved, that I am forgiven, that I am a child of God. But as I daily come to Jesus and confess my sin, this is part of my sanctification. This is part of him transforming me, shaping me into the person I need to be. So Jesus says, Peter, you don't need the shower, you just need your feet clean. You can think about it like this. I'm a creature of habit, and so I take a shower every single morning. Like, I can't even function without one. And so I always take one in the morning. But that is not the only time I wash my hands, right? I wash my hands after using the restroom or before I eat a meal or after working outside. So I'm a clean person, but I still need to wash my hands. And Jesus is saying, Peter, you're clean, you're saved, you're secure, but you still need that daily confession of sin so I can transform you into the person you need to be. So Peter and Jesus are having this dialogue, and Jesus makes one thing very, very clear. He says, look, most of you are clean, but not all of you. Did you notice that? That point at the very end, he's saying, look, I got 12 of you here. 11 of you are clean, but there's one that's not. And he's talking about Judas again. Judas just kind of serves as this cloud over the entire chapter of 13. And Jesus is saying, look, Judas, even though he followed me, and even though he saw me, and even though he learned from me, Judas was never a Christian. Judas was never a Christian. And the scary thing for me, and the scary thing probably for all of us, is that Judas looked like one, right? I mean, if anybody were watching Judas, you just would have assumed, like, of course this guy believes. I mean, he's following him. He's one of the 12. He even had a role. He even had a ministry job. He was the treasurer, all right, which he held all the money, which, like, draw your own conclusions, I guess. But, like, that, you know, like, that's kind of what he was doing. He served on Team Jesus, and he was not a Christian. And I think that this is a kind of public service announcement for all of us. That, man, following Jesus is more than just going through the motions. And it's more than just a set of behaviors. And it's more than even just serving in a ministry position. It's actually having your heart transformed. And Judas's was not. Judas's was not. And so Jesus alludes again to his whole crew that one of them is going to betray him. And again, Peter, our guy, man, Peter's the dude, all right? And Peter, he looks at John, who is sitting next to Jesus at the moment. He goes, John, ask him who it's going to be, all right? And Peter tries to get John's attention and say, ask Jesus, who's it going to be? And so John leans back and he says, Jesus, who is this betrayer? Like, who in the world would stab you in the back? Watch Jesus' words here. Chapter 13, verses 12 through 17. It said, when he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, do you understand what the point that I just made, that's not tied to this verse, all right? So I'm going to go ahead and read this verse and then make some other points, all right? This is me being imperfect, all right? Here we go. Let's read verses 12 through 17, and I'll make the points. I got ahead of myself. All right. When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, do you understand what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. So Jesus here, he's saying, look, I'm going to do this thing, but I'm not going to leave this up for interpretation because I'm worried that you'll misunderstand it, all right? I'm going to plainly and bluntly explain to you what I just did. He says, guys, this is an example, right? This wasn't just a one-time thing. This wasn't just me being nice on a particular night. This is an example of a behavior I want you to continue. He starts out and he's saying, look, no one is above the master. And if I am your teacher, if I am your Lord, and I wash feet, that means you're not above washing feet. If the king is not above serving, then no one is. And Jesus is saying, no matter what your rank, and no matter how important you think you are, no matter what position you hold, you are never above serving anyone. And that brings us to a good biblical principle that when we're reading the Bible and as we're watching Jesus live out his life, this is a good exercise for us to play out, right? The exercise goes like this. If he did this, then what does that mean for me, right? If Jesus did this, then how does that impact my life? So if Jesus washed feet, does that mean that I'm not above any act of service? And if Jesus fed the hungry, does that mean I should sacrifice to provide the needs of others, even when they can't pay me back? And if Jesus touched the sick, does that mean my love is to extend to everyone? If Jesus extended grace to the broken, does that mean I should stop judging others and extend a gracious hand? And if Jesus could live up, if Jesus gave up his life so that I could live, does that mean I should pour myself out too? See, Jesus' example can be summarized like this. When tempted to aim high, get low. When tempted to aim high, get low. See, the majority of messages that you and I have received throughout our entire lives are aim high. The commercials or the college counselors or even our loved ones have said you should get as much as you can. You should achieve as much as you can so that someday you can have the status that you deserve. And so it looks like go to the best college so that you can get the best job, so you can make the best money, so you can buy the best stuff, so that you can live in the best neighborhood, so your kids can go to the best school, so that they can go to the best college, so that they can get the best job, so that they can make the best money, so that they can buy the best stuff, so that they can live in the best neighborhood, so your grandkids can live in the right school district, and they can go to the best college, and they can get the best job, and they can get the best money, and they can get the best stuff, and then your great-grandkids can go to the best school, and they can go to the best college, and they can get the best job, and it is a cycle that never ends. And I think many of us are looking at each other and saying, man, I bought into that, and for some reason, it has not come through. Man, that's the dream I was sold on. That was the target that I was told to aim at, and for some reason, I have it all, and I'm still disappointed. And what Jesus is saying to his disciples, and he's saying to us, he's saying you were aiming at the wrong thing the whole time. That you bought into that message, you bought into that target, but that's actually not what fulfills at all. In fact, success is not found in status, it's found in service. That success is not about where I land on the org chart. Success is not about who thinks I have it all together. Success is actually about how do I serve. See, the author of life is unlocking the key right here. He's saying, you and I have bought into the misconception that if I pour myself out too much, then I will be empty. And Jesus says, no, no, no. If you pour yourself out, you will be more full than you could ever imagine. Success is not found in the status, it's found in service. So here we are, back to our point that I was trying to make a little too early, all right, is that Jesus and Judas were coming to a head. Peter had asked John who it was, and John asked Jesus, and this is how Jesus responds. He says, Jesus answered in verse 26, it says, it is he to whom I will give the morsel of bread when I have dipped it. So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said, what you're going to do, do quickly. So Jesus responds to John's question. He grabs a piece of bread, dips it, and hands it to Judas. And Judas was transformed. He was taken over. He was no longer calling the shots. The wheels had been set in motion. The betrayal was on its way. And Jesus says, go and just do it. Just do it quickly. I know what's coming. I release you. Go make it happen. My hour has come. Now, as I was imagining this whole thing playing out, like the whole dinner from start to finish, this is what really knocked me back. And it may seem super obvious, but I got to be honest, it absolutely cut me to the core. And this is the truth. If you really play all of this out, okay, chronologically speaking, in this dinner, Jesus washed Judas's feet. Jesus washed Judas's feet. Now, that may seem like a duh kind of thing to you, but it really knocked me back. You see, earlier it said that Jesus washed his disciples' feet. It did not say Jesus washed 11 out of 12. It did not say he really got into it with the 11, but he just kind of mailed it in when it got to Judas. It says that he washed them all. So hours before Judas was going to stab him in the back, Jesus served him. And I don't know about you, but that convicts me, because here's what's true about my service. When I think about the when I serve in my life, I find it relatively easy and simple to serve the people I already like. Anybody with me? Right? Like the people you love, your family, your loved ones, maybe your friends, maybe even people in your neighborhood, you can serve them. Or I will actually really easily serve someone if I think I'm going to get something back. Right? I will serve them if I think they have some hookups that I could use, or if I will really elevate myself in their eyes and I think that will benefit me in the future. But when it comes to washing someone's feet that maybe I don't like, or maybe someone that's hurt me, or maybe someone that's betrayed me, man, I don't really sign up for that job. And Jesus, knowing full well what Judas was about to do, in John chapter 6, it tells us that Jesus knew all along. Even though he knew he was going to stab him in the back, he washed his feet. And he's calling you and I to do the same. Now, there's a really good chance that you did not come here today with a folded up piece of paper, handwritten, that had a list of your enemies, right? Like, I hope not. I hope that's not true about you. If it is, we have counselors down front, all right, that will immediately hand you to Homeland Security. All right, like, We can't have that. But anyway, like, you probably most likely do not identify people as your enemies, but there are definitely some people that get on your nerves and some people that are hard to love and definitely hard to serve. So maybe for you, it's the fellow mom at your kid's school, and she seems perfect, right? The hair is perfect, and the makeup's perfect, and she's like Pinterest with legs on, right? Like, she's super creative, and like, you just cannot stand her, all right? She's the worst. And as you're watching her, you're like kind of hoping that things are bad at home, and you're like, you're just like wishing the worst on her because you got cereal all over the place, and it's just gross. And Jesus is saying, man, like, instead of judging her, I'm asking you to serve her. I want you to wash her feet. Or maybe for you, it's the coworker that is your political opposite. Right? You guys disagree about the president and gas prices and marriage laws, and he is loud and he is vocal. And all you want to do is one day in the lunchroom, expose him and tear him apart in a debate, right? That's all you want to do, is just show how fragile his worldview really is. And God's saying, instead of destroying him, I want you to serve him. I want you to wash his feet. Or maybe for you, it's the loud and obnoxious student in your dorm, and they are selfish, and they do not consider anyone else, and all you want to do is gossip about them and talk about them when they're not around. And Jesus is saying, I don't want you to gossip. I want you to serve them. I want you to wash their feet. When Jesus was talking about this being the example, he was including Judas. He said, I want you to live this out on a regular basis. Not only do you serve the people that you love, you serve your enemy. Now, I don't know about you, that is not my natural inclination. I just have to be honest. I don't wake up every day thinking, how can I serve the person that gets on my nerves the most? And that's because Jesus is pushing me outside of my comfort zone. And he's pushing me outside of my natural skill set, not to make me uncomfortable for no reason. But when I get outside of my comfort zone, that's when I'm dependent on Jesus. And the only way that I can wash Judas's feet is when I depend on Jesus Christ. That's the only way it happens. But Jesus says, this is the example. This is how I want you to live. Jesus wraps up chapter 13 with some vision casting. He's saying, look, you guys are going to be my representatives into the world, and here's how I want it to go down. Verses 34 and 35, as Jesus wraps up, he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. So Jesus is saying, look, eventually you are going to be the Christians. You're going to start the church. And I want your lasting reputation to be the way that you love one another. When outsiders look in on you, they may not agree with you. They may not believe what you believe, but they will certainly know that you love one another. And it is through the example of service that that can all be true. Jesus' love is patient, and it is gracious, and it is all the way to the end, and it is all the way to the cross. This is a love that cannot be found in some self-help book or a dating advice column. This is a love that keeps no records of wrongs. This is a revolutionary kind of love. And Jesus says, that's how I want my people to be in the world. That's how I want people to understand Christians. Now, that word love, I think, needs some clarity. Because when people read this verse, some people have taken it to such an extreme that they say, if as a church, as a group of Christians, we're supposed to love people, doesn't that mean that we just accept everyone and we never say anything that's controversial? We never confront them with anything that the Bible says? Like, love has kind of been co-opted into the free hugs campaign. And like, love is being nice, all right? Love is being nice. Now, I got to tell you that love is different than just being nice. In fact, love equals, your simple equation, love equals grace plus truth, right? Love equals grace plus truth. Earlier in John, as he was introducing Jesus, he said that Jesus is full of grace and truth, right? Full of both. Now, that does not mean that Jesus was 50% grace and 50% truth, and that made up all of Jesus. What John means is that Jesus was 100% grace and 100% truth, and that's what made up Jesus. There are not switches to where we're either or. It's always a both and that is the example of love. Now, many of us, we have one or the other that we err towards, right? Most of it's either kind of team grace or it's team truth, and we kind of have our preference or the way that we're naturally wired. But when we choose, we get into dangerous territory because one without the other is not love. See, Team Grace is very encouraging and is very nice, but it's not very truthful. And so it's almost like watching someone walk into oncoming traffic and having a very nice tone about it. Like, hey, you're great, and I believe that you're not in danger, and so if that's what you believe, then that's okay, and I just accept you the way you are. Meanwhile, there's a truck coming, all right? The truck wins, all right? That's just the fact, all right? That's the way it works. Truth is the other way, to where truth is always screaming about the truck that's on its way, but rarely extends a hand to walk people out of it. And truth has a lot of information, and they're probably right, but they don't have influence because they haven't loved anyone. And so love is grace and truth together. Truth is loving someone enough to point out the mess. And then grace is loving them enough to walk them through the mess. They go together. See, grace and truth are not incompatible. They're inseparable. They can't exist apart. They go one and another. And Jesus is saying, that is the way I want my people to be defined. And do you know the best way to show grace and truth? Do you know the best way to show love? It's to serve. So Jesus is saying, this is the example. This is what I want to be the defining action, the defining behavior of my people is service. So let's ask that big question, all right? If Jesus did this, then what does that mean for us? All right? If Jesus washed feet, what does that mean? Number one is this, service is the great pride killer, right? Service is the great pride killer. The best way for us to fully understand John 13 is for us to also understand Luke 22. See, in Luke 22, the disciples are hanging out with Jesus, and they get in this argument about who's the greatest. I mean, they're cool with being part of the 12, but they're kind of wondering, like, in history, how am I going to be ranked? Am I going to be, like, the number 7 disciple? Am I going to be the number 11 disciple? Judas, he's the 12th, all right? And so, how am I going to be in the grand scheme of things? And so while the disciples are over here arguing about who's the best, Jesus grabs a towel and he grabs a bowl of water and he takes a knee and he starts serving. So service is the great pride killer. That when I show up to serve someone, I'm not looking for the accolades, I'm not looking for glory, I'm not looking for the TV cameras to come and capture my behavior. I'm there to lift someone else up. So service is the great pride killer. The second one is that service is the great life giver. Service is the great life giver. See, Jesus uses this word. He says, you are blessed if you do this. You're blessed if you do that. That word blessed means that you have joy. It means contentment. It means fulfillment. And so Jesus is saying, we've been aiming at the wrong thing the whole time. We've been aiming at status when service was all along the thing that was going to give us life. When you pour yourself out, you are not empty. You are not dry. You are not tired. In fact, you're filled up. So here's what I'd like to do. I think it would be a missed opportunity if we talked about service and our call to do that without giving you a very real opportunity to do so. So here's what you can do. Around here on a weekly basis, we have hundreds of volunteer opportunities. There are short-term mission trips, both within our country and international. You can go on our website and click the Connect tab, and there you will find out all of our service opportunities. I'd like to highlight one for you tonight. There is an opportunity that we have in our city. We have developed a partnership with an organization called City Mosaic, and their mission is to have churches in the city of Indianapolis team up together to make a big difference in the city of Indianapolis. And so through City Mosaic, we have an opportunity at a school called School 43. It's an IPS school where we can go and we can make a big difference in the lives of students that do not have the same opportunities and, most importantly, the same relationships that you and I are afforded on a daily basis. So we can go in and we can encourage and we can love and we can play and we can have fun and we can laugh with some kids that really, really need it. And so by signing up for more information about School 43, you'll learn that you can go and you can assist a teacher who is greatly under-resourced. Or you can play with some kids that just need a male role model. And that you can give up your time and your energy to make a big difference, not necessarily halfway across the world, but in our backyard. See, we love Indianapolis, and we want Jesus to be the king of Indianapolis. We want people to know him in a very real way. And the best way of doing that is through love, which is grace and truth shown in service. So if you're interested in serving at School 43, actually, if you're just interested in finding out more information, there's two different things you can do. Through our church app, you can hit the connect button, and there you can fill out your information, and we will get you what it looks like to serve at School 43. Or you can go on our website this week, and you can click on the City Mosaic link, and you will find out more about School 43. Here's what I'm saying. They need about 100 volunteers to come in on a regular basis and serve in any way that they need, right? You do not need a master's degree, right? You do not need a certain number of dollars in your bank account. You do not need any level of expertise other than willingness and a heart of service. And we can make a big difference in a school that needs it here in our city. So they need about 100. I think we should do it. Right? I think we should. I think that a group like this, over three services, look around at everybody. I think we can make a massive difference and change the lives of some kids forever for the sake and the glory of Jesus. And so that's my ask, right? Is that we can make a big difference in School 43. We can make a big difference in the northwest side of Indianapolis, in the state of Indiana, the United States of America, and the world, not because of our own glory, not because we are smart enough, not because we are skilled enough, but because Jesus saved us, and out of a response to grace, that's why we serve. All right? Can I pray for you? I'd love to pray that we can be courageous enough to serve in a way that we're not really ready for, and that we can follow God's will for our lives. God, we love you so much, and we are so encouraged by your word. This is challenging, and this is not easy, and quite honestly, like, this isn't really the first thing on our minds. But you said this was the example, and you said this is how you wanted your people to be known, and so we hear you, and we want to respond to your word. Father, you are good, and you loved us to the end, and as a response to that, we give you our lives. It's in your incredible name I pray. Amen.